give you an idea of what Professor Nsi told me.
That's right.
So essentially, I read to him. I put it on Facebook actually, but if you've not seen it,
this is
his very well, not Marcelo Usu's, Professor Nsi's. I tell you this one here. Actually, essentially questioning whether we are citizens. That's very theoretical political science language there. But essentially what he's saying is that the transaction costs for citizenship in a place like Ghana are too high. I think he would want me to say that, yes, ordinary people very much want to get involved in the political process, but they don't have enough information. And also it is learning, which will a socialist comrade should have interrogated a bit more. But essentially, let's say it's difficult for us to be citizens. I'm paraphrasing. In point of fact, I just say that most of us are not citizens. Most of us are subjects. I mean, the classical, somewhat old-fashioned argument of citizenship by T.H. Marshall. I mean, we don't qualify for political citizenship. Most of us, in the first place, not enough of us pay tax. If I actually, quite a lot of us pay tax through VAT and so on and so forth. But very few of us knowingly pay tax and so on and so forth. So we don't act like citizens. We don't exact accountability. Professor Nsi notes all the difficulties. Well, as a good socialist, he's also very hopeful. So when I put it pointedly to him, that's why we citizens or not, I would say he said about maybe about 30% citizens. Let me put it that way. But I mean, as I said on Facebook, one thing that I had completely forgotten. I mean, when Prof taught us, I don't know what you remember, political economy in 1979, he was actually campaigning. So he would come to lectures and show after the weekend campaigning, he'd come and explain to us exactly what was happening in the field. And I was discussing with somebody on Facebook, and one of my new friends on Facebook. I mean, I've been going around the country, visiting the festivals, and also paying attention to outdoor political advertising. It's something I've been doing for quite some time. And I would still say that, at least so far, this is a much poorer campaign, even compared to 2012, and definitely compared to 2008. I mean, 2008, right after the famous Battle of the 17. I mean, we were waiting to huge billboards. I mean, now, compared to 2008, what has happened so far, I don't know whether it will. Like, in Takrad, actually, it's very, very funny. I mean, because of the death of the idea of the oil city, about 60, maybe 70% of the billboards in Takrad, they're actually empty. So you have these ugly concrete structure shells. The politicians are not able to occupy those empty billboards. So they are going around creating very ugly, especially the NDC, bamboo structures. I mean, was not the case in even 2012. Because I remember very well that in 2012, in point of fact, because of politics, some billboards were specifically erected across the road. I mean, that must have cost hundreds of thousands of dollars just to put up political banners. And of course, later they became commercial billboards. But now they can't do that. Anyway, so I was talking to Prof about the situation in the northern part of Accra, where he lives, the Tundra Hills and Go. And his point was that, well, it's much more expensive these days. And he spoke a lot in very practical terms about the logistics of his own campaign and how things must be much more expensive
in 79.
In 79, as compared to that. But actually, the more I think about it, I think it's also just a matter of technology. I mean, like, I remember Prof's beautiful billboard very well. I'm sure it was silk printed, black and white, blah, blah, blah. Actually, that's a much more expensive process than printing a glossy digital print, whatever. But I know most of the politicians actually are designing their posters themselves. Or they have in-house people design their posters. You can now go to the corner shop, print house to print it, and so on and so forth.
But apart from technology, aren't you also overlooking the possibility that campaign expenditures are going into probably more direct
that's
forms
the point.
Of
exactly. Enablement.
Yes. Instead of this mass advertising, that perhaps citizens are expecting more direct payoffs and therefore monies are being spent.
That's a very important point that Prof made. Actually, I mean, earlier in the chapter, he makes the point that we have this paradox. Well, obviously, we have very high participation in terms of turnouts in the vote. But perhaps if you look at this rationally, these people don't really have the information. I mean, it's a bit, in certain ways, it can be a bit surprising. But that level of engagement, I don't know what our typical turnout rates are now. I'm sure about 80% or something like that. Which in global terms is
still very, very high.
So, I mean, Prof's point was that, well, if these people don't feel enabled, if they don't really feel part of the national policy processes and so on and so forth, why do we have such high participation rates? In fact, this is more from his chapter in the book rather than my conversation with him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think his argument is, actually that argument has been made much more forcefully in a paper on politics in Ahafo. I mean, somehow the Borno Ahafo region tends to produce very, very good politicized essays. I mean, of course, one of the classic essays is John Dunn's Politics in Ahafo. And now there's a lady, I think McLaren, has published very, very interesting paper in African Studies Quarterly on everyday politics in Ahafo. And essentially what she did is to combine the quantitative things that we have, Afro Barometer and Co., and did the writing in a mixed methods way, did a lot of qualitative research, went and stayed in the village. And essentially, yes, people feel it's their time to chop, essentially. I mean, the political season is translated in a way in which you satisfy, that's the best time to satisfy your quite immediate and direct consumption needs. There's a point that when I spoke to Kevin, Professor Kevin Freely,
mm-hmm.
the point that he made as well. Anyway, so this gives some idea, I mean, Professor Nsentence, that, well, we are in about a halfway house towards citizenship. The structure is difficult, it's understandable that we don't have citizenship. I would say that most of us are subjects. So, I think that gives enough of a landing point.
I don't disagree. I mean, I think I have also referred to us as more as subjects than as citizens. I mean, if you look at it, I like to look at these things from some agency theory perspective, right? So if we conceive of the relationship between the citizen and the governed, the governor and the governed as one between principal and agent, the governor being the principal, the governor, of course, the citizen being the principal, collectively being principals and the governors being the agents, it appears that now in our system it is almost inverted. I mean, that expectation that these guys are our principals, our agents, and they answer to us, they do things for us, and they have to have their... It's not a conception of citizenship that most Ghanaians, I think, get. And in a sense, you know, it's probably not a peculiarly Ghanaian thing. Certainly, if you look at the latter-day democracies, we are coming to democracy quite differently from the ways in which the advanced democracies came to democracy. We are coming to universal adult suffrage, let me put it more bluntly that way, quite differently. You know, we're coming to it in a very big bang fashion. These advanced democracies came to it quite incrementally. And so I think that the process of evolving into citizenship really took a much longer period. You had to have a stake in the system. It began with property owners, and then you had to become a taxpayer, and there were literacy tests for some people. And these things grew over time. And I think that each one of those processes you could see, I would like to see those processes in those countries as almost the evolution into citizenship, right? That you had to have a stake. It was oftentimes measured sometimes in racial terms, sometimes in gender terms. I mean, women did not have votes in many of these places until later, and then, but oftentimes in economic terms, be a property owner, and then finally be a taxpayer. You know, and I think that finally, then, you know, at a certain intellectual level, when these Western societies felt that they had diffused at least education sufficiently, that you had the instruments of becoming at least a middle class person. That's when most of them actually accepted universal adult suffrage. And I think that those incremental processes of evolving into citizenship, certainly we do not have that luxury. I mean, we have to do democracy in a big bang fashion. And therefore, those who would be at the level of citizenship of the old, in the old European sense, quite a few people. You know, those who have a stake in the system, measured in an economic sense, property owners, taxpayers, like Amos said. I mean, many of us are not taxpayers. And even where we are, it is of the indirect type. We don't really recognize that there's a transactional relationship between us and the state. So I think it's almost in the nature of our evolution into democracy, or the nature of our inauguration into democracy, just ensures that very few of us would be really in the position to see ourselves as citizens. And then, of course, you have all the other intermediate and intervening considerations, ethnicity, other issues of identity, where, of course, our membership of those categories are more organic and more much firmer, you know. And so, yes, I think definitely that is a challenge, evolving a democracy in a system where the polity, where the governed have a very weak conception of themselves as citizens, as principals, and of the governors as agents or as servants, so to speak, public servants. I mean, trying to have a democracy in that kind of a system is bound to be challenging. And I really don't know that we have come to terms.
I understand that according to that full barometer, quite a few of the elites in Ghana and other African countries think that many other, of course, definitionally poorer people should not be allowed to vote.
Well, I haven't, looked at that Afro-Brahmin data, but it would not surprise me. And I think that, again, as I said, if you look at the way in which Western societies came to democracy, that incremental graduation into citizenship, into membership of the polity, into responsible membership of the polity, is not an option that has been available to us. And I think that more and more the middle classes probably are beginning to feel the pinch. They're beginning to feel besieged. It's like, well, we pay, or at least they have a sense of themselves as the ones who, on whose backs, at least domestically, on whose backs the state is carried, and the political class is carried. And yet, democracy, if it's a numbers game, means that they are not totally overwhelmed numerically. And therefore, they are bound to feel a bit almost underrepresented. I mean, so I'm not surprising that we are beginning to see this kind of a reaction, which Afro-Brahmin has picked up. It really doesn't surprise me at all. I think that a number of middle classes in Africa are bound to have some bias remorse if they begin to think of the version of democracy that is evolving as of the more populist, some very perverse form of democracy that really doesn't produce the kind of boost they were expecting, doesn't deliver the public services they were expecting, doesn't deliver all the other democracy dividends they may have been expecting, rule of law, or law and order, all those kinds of things that middle class people would like. So, it doesn't surprise me at all. I have picked some of that sentiment as well, even on social media, in the sense in which, this foot soldier kind of democracy is beginning to.
And Napoleon, as a reliable socialist, so what do you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, if you really see that the middle class are being quite nervous, that if this is what we signed up for,
Napoleon, what do you say to that?
No, I think that.
We need qualified democracy.
No, I think that Prof is right in the sense that democracy came to the West in a gradual formation. They were adding as time went on. While certain sectors actually did struggle, for example, women's vote, they did have to struggle for long in order to achieve that. But in our specific case, there are certain challenges. For example, if the middle class thinks that certain sectors should not be, because maybe they don't pay taxes. But the bulk of the taxes comes from cocoa farmers.
Sure, exactly.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
Exactly.
Yeah. So how do you reconcile that? Because now we know more and more that the middle class, more or less, the first section is unproductive, parasitic.
Yeah.
They take from the state, they don't add. So if you look at, in terms of corruption across Africa, it is mainly the middle class with political party leaders and so on. So how do you reconcile it? And I think that the issue of the food soldiers is important in the sense that they are the group who more or less are paid by the political party leaders to create the unnecessary tensions that we see across. So how do you do away with it and at the same time say we are building a nation? The food soldiers are not in the majority. If you take in the specific case of Ghana, what I call illegal formations, be it the Kandahar Boys or Azoka or Bulldogs or whatever, Afghans, whatever. They are a tiny minority.
You're talking about the militias.
Yes.
But the food soldiers extend well beyond
The food.
No, the food soldiers is well beyond it. But the food soldiers leaders are from these particular groups.
Honestly, I mean, I've been trying to really, but that's why.
If you look at, for example, when the PNDC was talking of food soldiers, the NDC was talking of food soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the profile of those food soldiers, they are more or less people who aspire to be in the middle class and did it.
And did it?
Yes.
Didn't quite get it.
Didn't quite get there.
Disappointed with the class.
Yeah, if you take, there's always a statement from Kedes, and it is from issued in Koforidua.
Do I see? The United Kedes Front?
Whatever. Look at the list. Look at. They were people who were prominent at particular stage, but they never quite made it, and they were left behind. So they travel, they come together and they say, look, we can be relevant, we can get our share of the national cake if we say we, the food soldiers, we do A, B, C, D. So you have to look at it. Even look at, again, for example, the NDC Congress in Koforidua, where there was a lot of violence and so on and so forth, bed and cold.
Yes.
Again, look at it, food soldiers. Food soldiers. So,
but what I was going to say, just observing the political process at the micro level, you talk about difference. Actually, the percentage, see, in political science, you normally, at least in standard knowledge as we have it, very few people, if you talk about political parties and interest aggregation, very few people are really directly involved in the political process, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
Talking to people in my focus groups, what amazes me, I don't know, and I think it's special about this election, is there's a big enlargement of people who are directly involved in political work. A huge enlargement.
This is...
And especially from the middle class.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this on one side only.
Predominantly MPP.
On the predominantly MPP.
But it's not bad on the NDC side either.
But it's interesting. I mean, I think it goes back to the middle class point. I think the middle class probably had a certain expectation that democracy was going to serve their class interest.
Mm-hmm.
And as they are beginning to see it, it's not turning out that quite that way.
Yes.
And so this is almost a certain quiet class revolution on the part of the middle class saying, look, if we do not actually work at this, if we do not really rise up and really defend our own interests as a class, then this democracy will go in directions that will be inimical to our interests.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So it's you see a clear awakening. And I don't know that it's only one, but I've seen that. At least in the MPP, I've seen it. That, and I was surprised to see that myself, that the kinds of groupings that I've seen emerge and the kinds of monies that they are raising from their own private pockets to really fund things not even scripted by the party itself. Mm-hmm. They're doing ground,
independent
door-to-door things that is amazing. Yeah. And I think that clearly the middle class is now beginning to have a sense that, you know, the democracy has gone in highly populist directions that may not be to the advantage, and therefore they need to actually have a direct role in this process. And to that extent, I mean, I think that is fine. I mean, they increasingly have more consciousness of themselves as a class, but also as citizens, and that might explain why the cocoa farmers, even though they've carried us on our backs for so long, never had a consciousness of themselves as taxpayers. Mm-hmm. The reason why cocoa farmers have been taxed for all these years, but have never really formed a huge political force and demanded, say, like the Kenyan coffee growers or other countries, that the Ghanaian cocoa farmer is a peasant and doesn't have a conception of themselves as taxpayers. Yeah. They don't know that they are paying tax. You know, but the middle class, I think, has a different conception of itself now, whether they pay tax or not. They still believe that democracy should have served their interests. It's not serving. I think that is it's a good thing in terms of citizenship.
You see, the reason why there's awakening, there are several factors that the living standard of the middle class the last few years has been going back. Because you want a stable supply of certain essentials that in a democracy, that should be available in a democracy. Energy, water, security. You want to have it. It is accepted that it is a norm. It is there. So you don't have to. But if you look at how the erosion has come in, and somebody was telling me something very interesting, that if you look at the middle class areas and you compute how much they paid for buying fuel to generate electricity, how to buy water, its impact here is something that awakes them, that we have to have a direct input into democracy. And people also now are looking at it that, look, if we don't take a direct impact, a direct action, we will be having the same kind of government that we can't do anything about for the next 4 years. So it is better I contribute financially, technically, whatever wise, in order for change to take place, so that at least the government that I want would be there. If they don't do it, then that's another level of struggle. So you see the professionals for change, you see the various women's groups, and 18 months ago, I saw the wives of ex-generals who were working, and they said, we are working for MPP. And these are wives of senior generals who retired in the 70s. And I was shocked that they could have come to that consciousness. You see, so it's a new phenomenon, and I think that it is good for the country. The only thing is that party leaders must listen to the voices of it, because they are contributing money, transport, food.
It's amazing.
Brother BB, you are our honorary economist here.
Well, I think the point that Chrissy made is very interesting, and especially for me, the consciousness of the lower class awakening. Of course, we cannot go back to the evolution days, mm-hmm. where you have to be a property owner to, mm-hmm. or a taxpayer, mm-hmm. to be eligible, exactly. or to be a citizen. Mm-hmm. So you have to go the shortcut.
That's right.
But what seems interesting to me is that even when I say that I see a lot more middle class people getting into the fray for the MPP in particular, what is also interesting to me is that they are not saying that we are members of the MPP. Mm-hmm. Which is to say that they still want to be able to influence, mm-hmm. the elections, mm-hmm. but still want to be able to hold the MPP influence accountable. Mm-hmm. Should they win? Mm-hmm. That we are not your members. Mm-hmm. We want to support you now for a change, mm-hmm. because we believe that you probably will have the key to unlock.
Which to some extent happened in 2000 as well.
Exactly.
Right? Young executives.
But that. Young executive was
MPP.
But if you look at this,
okay.
Let my vote count, mm-hmm. and the alliance for blah blah blah, mm-hmm. they are all saying that no, we are not members of the MPP. Mm-hmm. And for me, the fact that they are working towards MPP means that look, we believe in your cause, mm-hmm. but if you come into government, mm-hmm. we are going to hold you with the same level of expectation. For me, that is what is interesting for me. And I think this is what would make the democracy a lot more established. Because if the middle class is also going to just look at MPP and say that we belong to you, we are going to defend you no matter what.
That's right.
They would have lost it.
That's right.
Absolutely. Ghana would have lost it. But we need a certain critical mass that can always hold all kinds of government accountable. Mm. And I believe that if there is a change, I would expect that this couple of people will still be able to hold the party accountable, unless some of them, for all kinds of reasons, maybe get transited with ministerial.
Yeah, but you know, if you look at the numbers involved, it's clearly not, it's not purely opportunistic. I mean, I've looked at the numbers and the identities of people involved in this. These are not people who are necessarily big party insiders or looking for a position. But of course, there are some who are doing this to get noticed, mm-hmm. by the oligarchs in the party, and then in the expectation that there will be some future positions. And, yeah. But just the sheer numbers of people involved clearly convinces me that some of what we're seeing is
let's, and that was very good.
And in the case, in that sense, I think it's also for the first time within our democracy, I think it's a struggle within democracy, right? I mean, we haven't struggled in a sense. Middle classes in Ghana, at least the professional classes, have struggled for democracy only in a very limited sense in our history, against military regimes, for transition back to civilian governments. That has been the mode of their engagement. So they normally, and it's understandable, their fortunes tend to wane under military regimes, especially if you take lawyers, they don't get to go to court, they don't get to do a lot of business. So they've almost always been against military regimes and have been very forceful in getting transitions to take place. Once democracy comes, I think this is probably the first time that we begin to see struggles within democracy by a middle class to assert themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the beginning of something good. I really think that essentially citizenship should be the product of struggle, not bestowed on you, you know, just because the constitution says you are a citizen or given to you in a top-down fashion. I think for the first time, we are going to begin to see citizens, middle-class persons struggling actually to earn their citizenship. And for me, that's the way I like to see it. I think that's actually something positive.
Actually, I have a much less sanguine view. I mean, Takoradi is a bit of an outlier in Ghana now for all sorts of complex reasons. But yesterday, I spent a lot of time at the ANC mall. Mm-hmm. And essentially, I mean, Takoradi things are very, very expensive. I mean, all the nice bars and hotels really cannot even really be effectively patronized by the Ghanaian middle class, mm-hmm. not even those who work in oil service companies. So I went around the ANC mall, a new food court, and I expected a more Ghanaian ownership. And it just turns out bloody expensive. I mean, went to a place, a very funky place, I don't want to mention it, which says Ghanaian food and so. And for a PC or something, that's usually I'm looking at about 50 cities.
Wow.
I mean, that's a lot.
Yeah.
So, in a sense, you see, political action is engendered by all sorts of different drives. Mm-hmm. And normally, I think in theory, we expect that the most sustained kind of action will be driven by post-materialist values. If you are forced into politics only for basic survival, I mean, in the first place, what that means is that if that relative deprivation is removed, or if there's a certain sudden, I mean, for example, we all agree that the economy is very difficult now. What it means is that, for instance, if it's a sudden improvement in macroeconomic figures, interest rates come down, blah, 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 maybe by some magic, utility rates, I mean, charges go down, this kind of, I mean, new citizenship that we are seeing might not be sustained. The other thing I think about is the Arab Spring, and I mean, similar things in other world countries. I mean, generally, they've not gone the way we expected. We've not seen the Arab Spring yet. Until the day that there's a revolution in Ghana, like there was in Kenya, because rich men are taking over the lands of primary schools. Mm-hmm. Until the day that I see a situation in Ghana, because in point of fact, like, galamseys are polluting our water, and we have a proper aluta.
Okay.
I mean, on these. So that's what I'm saying. There are different qualities of political engagement.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect that what is driving this heightened engagement now is a much more base need. And it's not of a sufficiently high political quality.
You know, if you read